This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is off this week. Coming up, a new study confirms that Black women are being cheated out of a fair take-home pay. A big promotion for the guy who handles President Obama's kill list. And keeping track of the bodies of African Americans murdered under color of law. But first, it's the week of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, an occasion for speechifying and sermonizing by politicians and preachers who have no connection whatsoever to the assassinated leader's actual politics. If Dr. King were alive today, what would he do and say? We asked Dr. Cornell West of Union Theological Seminary in New York.
First, we have to say that Brother Martin was full of Black prophetic fire, which means that he was a warrior for truth and a warrior for justice. And I think he would highlight two things in the present age of Obama. He would highlight Wall Street criminality, crimes committed on Wall Street that remain unpunished, uninterrogated, unaccountable. He would highlight the war crimes coming out of the White House and the Pentagon and State Department in terms of the drones dropping bombs on innocent people, over now 180 and 90 children just in Pakistan and Yemen. We don't even know how many it is across the board. And third, he would highlight the social crimes of the new Jim Crow, which is the criminal justice system, which is itself criminal, that allows for wiretappers, torturers, war criminals to go free and yet sends drug offenders to jail and sends whistleblowers like Brother Bradley Manning to jail. Martin would be very, very, very sad when he looked at the fraudulent character of Black leadership, the degree to which there's almost a massive capitulation to the White House with no serious concerns about keeping Black prophetic fire, which means taking the risk, which means going to the edge, and which means loving the people enough to tell them the truth rather than what is convenient. I think Martin would be very down and out. It'd be deep tears in his eyes, and we got to make sure that we put a smile on his face.
In fact, we're not speculating on what Dr. King would do, because Dr. King actually has probably the most detailed record of any of our past leadership in terms of his own writings and his own public statements. And we know that in 1967, he broke ranks with a president who, at some levels, had become an ally of the movement that Dr. King was a part of.
Absolutely. You know, there's a new book out called A Single Garment of Destiny, edited by Lewis Baldwin. It talks about King, the global King, the King against imperialism, the King against colonialism, the King fighting for poverty, the King critical of capitalism. That's the Martin King that we need to zero in on. Well, I want to thank Brother Lewis Baldwin, introduction by Charlotte Hunter Goat. Just came out this week. In fact, I read it all last night. I stayed up all night just reading every word of that. But the thing is, even as we talk about Martin, though, it's not just talking about him as an individual. It is the Black prophetic tradition that produced him. So that you've got to talk about Malcolm, and you got to talk about Malcolm coming out of Garvey saying the Negro is not afraid. The Negro is willing to speak the truth and bear witness. The ruin and disaster of the masses of Black people must be the starting point, even as we connect the poor people of all colors all around the world. So it means, of course, you're going to be voices in a wilderness, because we're living in a late capitalist wilderness. We're living in a cultural wasteland where mendacity and conformity and complacency and cowardice has become ubiquitous.
When Dr. King broke with the administration over the Vietnam War, he characterized the military-industrial complex as a great sucking machine that was sucking out all of the resources of the country into war. What would he say in this age of austerity?
Well, one, he would always connect that military-industrial complex to both a sucking machine but also a killing machine. And I think he would say there ought to be a peace race rather than a war race. That was the language that he used. There ought to be a peace race, but he knew there's no peace without justice. and there's no justice without courageous truth-telling and witness-bearing. And so I think that, you know, if he looked at the terrain today of America, he would say America is on the road to self-destruction based on greed and based on refusal to come to terms with the suffering in its midst. If he looked at black America, he would be, I mean, he wouldn't be on his way to the crack house, but he would think about it. Because the level of suffering and misery and the level of confusion, the level of desperation, but also the level of capitulation of our leadership. But to keep in mind now, when Martin died, 72% of Americans disapproved of him and 55% of black Americans disapproved of him. So he was not the popular figure that everybody projects. His truths were just too strong.
When Martin was assassinated, he was in the process of launching a poor people's campaign. And yet today, aside from some voices such as yours, we don't hear about poverty at all.
Well, we got the Black Agenda Report, thank God. We got Counterpunch, thank God. We got True Dig, thank God. We got Democracy Now, thank God. Brother Tab is still out there doing his thing. You got Sister Nellie Bailey and the others doing their beautiful thing. But it is true that at the moment, the black prophetic tradition is very weak and feeble. Well, we're going to bounce back. We've been weak and feeble before. Truth crushed to earth shall rise again.
And do you hear the movements of truth emerging, bouncing back today, and how?
Well, there is a hunger among the young folk, and I'm spending most of my time now with young people. This is, I try to spend most of my time now with and in the elementary schools and the prisons and things, because there's a hunger and a thirst. People want the real thing. You know, it's after the sunset. Give me something real that won't fade in the light of day. People are hungry for the real thing. It's just that it's so difficult for them to gain access to it in the cultural superficial spectacle.
Many of us believe that mass black incarceration is the number one challenge facing black folks domestically in this country today. And yet it doesn't seem to be much of a priority among what we'll call the black leadership class.
No, the black leadership class has a class bias. If black middle class youth were going to jail at the same level of black poor youth, then it would affect what they have to say and do. But of course, they also have a black president that won't say a mumbling word about the new Jim Crow. Can you imagine having a black president in 1948 not saying a word about Jim Crow, but everybody's excited because he's symbolic breakthrough?
Well, why would he say a word if those black folks that he interacts with aren't saying anything either?
Yeah, that's true, too. We got to put pressure on it. We got to put pressure. But in the end, it really is about accenting the capacities and the abilities of everyday people. Because, I mean, you know, what we're up against is just gangster-like in its indifference and contempt for the suffering of poor and working people.
What do you mean, gangster-like?
Well, the difference between a hypocrite and a gangster is the hypocrite acts as if they're concerned, but they're really not, whereas the gangster just figures they can say anything and do anything and get away with it. Just like the banks, we could always just pay money and settle and never have to go to jail. That's gangster-like. It'd be like somebody shooting your friend or my friend, and all they got to do is pay a little money and don't go to jail. That's gangster-like, man. That's dead-up gangster-like. And you and I, we grew up with black gangsters. You know what I mean? We know who gangsters are. We grew up with black gangsters. I'm a Christian, so I love everybody. But I know what a gangster is. It's folks who think they can get over by any means and do anything they want in order to promote their own power, position, and status and money. And in that sense, we live in a highly gangsterized society.
And that's one of those triple evils that Dr. King talked about, materialism.
It's materialism, racism, poverty, but also militarism. And by militarism, he meant imperialism. And Martin was hitting all four of those at the same time. And all of them are connected to forms of catastrophe. And we need to accent that. And as you know, every January, Martin is deodorized and sanitized over and over again. But we got to keep the funk in Martin alive. And that funk tells the truth. That funk keeps reality right in front of our faces.
That was author, activist, and educator Dr. Cornel West in New York City. In Philadelphia, we spoke with Dr. Tony Montero, professor of African American Studies at Temple University.
I think for anyone that takes the time to read what Dr. King said, and I would say in particular his April 1963 letter from Birmingham jail and his April 1967 A Time to Break Silence, Why I Opposed the War in Vietnam. If you read those, it's very apparent. King would be in righteous opposition to the American regime of austerity and war, and the president and his administration that are in the vanguard of those. It's not rocket science. It's very clear. King was, at the end of the day, a democratic revolutionary, by which I mean he was calling for a democratic revolution from the people, an uprising, albeit a nonviolent, organized mass resistance to the forces of injustice and of war.
When Dr. King made that speech in 1967 at the Riverside Church, many folks thought, well, the black movement, black folks are in a really good position. We have a president, Lyndon Johnson, who's become somewhat of an ally of the movement. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like the height of folly to break with that president in particular.
Those who oppose King's turn to unite the civil rights movement with the peace movement, they considered it even worse than folly. They considered it betrayal of the president that signed the Civil Rights Act. And more than that, they considered King to have become a race traitor, that he had betrayed the black race and its hopes of civil rights. As it turns out, King's critics were absolutely wrong. And today, we're talking about Martin Luther King and not his critics.
In other words, King's message has proven to be the one that spoke to the ages.
Yes, that's right. We don't talk about Roy Wilkins. There is no national holiday or really even a national discussion of the legacy of Roy Wilkins or the legacy of Whitney Young, who was the head of the Urban League at that time. We talk about Martin Luther King, and we talk about the people who stood with Martin Luther King in Birmingham. For example, Fred Shuttlesworth, or people who were in the forefront of the struggle to organize black peasants to stand up for their right to vote, such as Fannie Lou Hamer, or Stokely Carmichael, or Ella Baker. These are the people we remember, not the people who were the critics of Martin Luther King, because what Martin Luther King stood for placed him on the right side of history, and what the others stood for placed them ultimately on the wrong side of history. And on these matters, I think King is absolutely right. It comes out in the letter from a Birmingham jail. You cannot make a butchery of your conscience. You cannot sell your values out, your worldview out, in the interest of cheap and immediate political calculation.
After King's death, however, a whole new slew of so-called leaders arose, and they said that we had to become more sophisticated and that direct action and speaking truth to power and raising hell, well, that was passé.
Yeah, well, that was the whole debate that took place in the 70s and 80s, and was kind of shut down after the 80s, who should be the spokesmen and leaders of the black community, the activists or the politicians? Ultimately, because of powerful political and financial interests, the politician became the new black leaders. And as such, our new black leaders were those people most closely tied to the institutions of economic and political power. And hence, our leaders spoke less and less for the interests of black people and more for the interests of the system as such, and in particular, of big capital, Wall Street and Washington interests.
In his letter from a Birmingham jail, you have some insights into that. Much of it was directed at people that we would call Southern liberals of the time, but you believe that King has a very incisive critique of the black church embedded in that document.
Not just embedded, but explicitly criticized the black church for being too close to and connected to the power structure of Birmingham, Alabama. Now, of course, he frames it as a critique of the white church, which was, of course, one of the main pillars of segregation and black oppression of that time. But it is obvious that he is also talking about those so-called moderates and pragmatists within the black church. And he criticizes the church for its willingness to accept a stability and peace based upon oppression rather than to pick up the mantle of struggle against the system of oppression. It's very apparent what he's talking about. And that is more so the case today than it was in 1963.
Of course, King was a black Baptist, and most of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference were Baptist preachers, but they were not indicative of the black church at that time.
And King made that clear. He said if he had to, it would not be a big thing for him to abandon the physical church for the church of the soul, the church of the spirit. And he felt ultimately the church was not the buildings, but the values, the beliefs, the human bonds. And, you know, in that letter from a Birmingham jail, he talks about the spirit of the original church, which he identifies as a church that opposed the regime, a church that was underground, a church that knew what it stood for, knew what its values were.
If Dr. King were alive today, what would his position be regarding this current administration, the first black presidency?
Well, you know, when King was alive, someone asked him, Dr. King, do you think there will ever be a black president? And he answered that he could conceive of there being a black president, but that his interest was not in having a black president, but in the freedom of black people. So here we are today, where we have a black president, but in many ways, when you look at the social indicators and the economic indicators, black people are less free today than we were 50 years ago.
And in fact, levels of poverty have sunk to around, just hovering a fraction of a percentage above, the levels of 1966.
Right, and they're probably worse, because I am of the opinion that the data does not fully reflect levels of impoverishment, especially when you have a million black people, primarily African-American men, and primarily African-American men in the most productive economic years of their lives in prison. One would have to say that the levels of poverty are far worse than we are told they are by official government statistics. But even more than that, what they call poverty, $22,000 for a family of three, is abject poverty, poverty out of which you will never escape. You got that impoverished group, but then you have around it a whole set of other people who work every day who are effectively poor people. And I would even suggest that the poverty of today, this urban, grinding poverty of the inner city, is far more destructive than the rural poverty of the Jim Crow period.
When we think of King's time, that era that we loosely call the 60s, black folks made great strides in a very relatively short span of time. Now there are about, I believe, 42 black members of Congress. But does that mean that black folks have a greater ability to effectuate change than we exhibited back 40 years ago?
50 years ago, really? No. No, the fact of the matter is black folks are less positioned to affect change than we were 50 years ago. And that is because, as King understood, as every revolutionary in history has understood, power comes from the people, mobilized, organized, educated, and clear. That is where power comes from. That's what Frederick Douglass understood. Power concedes nothing without a demand. What we see with the black elected officials are people who have been absorbed into the institutions of power in the United States, and they make very few, if any, demands upon the system. We were more powerful 50 years ago because we were mobilized to make demands upon the system. That is not the case today. And, of course, most of these elected officials will represent a new class, a new petty bourgeois class. And I would suggest nothing similar or approximating what Du Bois talked about in 1903 when he talked about a talented tent. This is a separated tent, a group of people who look with utter contempt upon the masses of black people and who, in fact, are blinded to the interest of the race as a whole by their consumption patterns, the things that they have. So they think that they have arrived, and because they think they have arrived, they transfer that to the rest of black people. We're free now, and all of the problems are the result not of, of oppression, but of the cultural patterns of the poor black people. So they've adopted the ideology and worldview of the oppressing class, and as such, function in the interest of that class.
And yet Dr. King had lots to say in word and deed about class.
Yes, he did. Yeah, you know, it's so interesting that King spoke about these things in the language of his audience. And that was the language of black folk, most of whom were connected to the principal institution of the black community, the black church. So when he spoke about class, he spoke about it in terms of ideology and politics. For example, the black bourgeoisie were defined as those people who have separated themselves from the great mass of their people. And he was constantly testing them. The Poor People's March was not only a way of protesting poverty, but testing just how far the bourgeois, petty bourgeoisie among black folk were prepared to go to secure freedom for the masses of black people. Yeah, so he was very conscious, I think, of class.
And what is the class content of the black political conversation today?
It's obvious. The black bourgeoisie have two foundations ideologically. One is the prosperity gospel, and so most of them go to church, drive fine cars to church, wear fine clothing to church, and go to these relatively fine mega churches and listen to good music and the preaching of the prosperity gospel, which is a perversion of the foundation of Christian ethics. The other foundation of their worldview is Barack Obama. So the identity, the social and ideological and class identity of the current black petty bourgeoisie is prosperity gospel and Barack Obama. Now, that is why they are so passionate and vociferous in saying to those who would criticize Obama that you need to shut up. You might be telling the truth, but it's not time for that. We have to work some things out, which means that the questions of poverty and war and austerity and repression and imprisonment have to be taken off the table in the interest of this new bourgeoisie consolidating its relationships through Obama, through the political establishment and the Democratic Party. They're establishing their new relationships with the corporate establishment of this country.
Sounds like the February 30th movement, a movement whose time never comes.
Exactly. You know, King in that letter from a Birmingham jail talked about the tragic misconception of time. He says that people who argue that it's not time for militancy, it's not time for struggle, have a tragic misconception of time, that our time does not come because it is inevitable that it would come. It comes because we fight for it. We make time. Time doesn't make us. And, you know, you look at this new class of bourgeois academics who are anything but the type of organic intellectual that you would find in a Martin Luther King or, let us say, a Mumia Abdul-Jamal or others. These people either believe they have arrived and believe that we have entered the period of an end of history, or they believe that time, taking its normal course, will resolve whatever existing problems continue to exist.
That reminds me of some who argue that it was demographics that won the election for President Obama. And if demographics rule, then one doesn't have to agitate, organize, or do anything special but just watch the children grow.
Right, 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 right. That we're going to become a nation with a majority or the minority. I don't think people understand the history of racial formation in the United States who make that kind of claim. Other people have argued that, well, the normal progression of technology will resolve all of the social and racial contradictions in the society. You know, all of that ways to obscure the essence of oppression and injustice in this country.
The essence of what Dr. King did with his nonviolent direct action was to bring contradictions to a boil, not to paper them over and try to infiltrate the established order.
And he said it almost exactly like you put it, that nonviolent resistance was a way of creatively tightening tension in order to resolve the underlying foundation of tension. You know, in Birmingham, the people who opposed King were saying that you are coming into Birmingham and creating tension, that we, the good white people and the good black people of Birmingham, can sit around the table and work out all of the problems that we have. But rather than allowing us to do what we can do, you have, for your own selfish reasons, come here and created tension. And what King says is that the type of creative tension that he and SCLC advocated was a way of resolving the underlying contradiction. He said there's nothing wrong with tension. The question is whether the tension has a creative resolution to it, you see. So certainly, when they went into Birmingham and they began to demonstrate, they created a backlash from white Birmingham, from Bull Connor, from the police. And he said that they and SCLC were not afraid of that tension because they understood that to heighten these contradictions, to bring them to the fore, was the only way of possibly resolving them. As long as you did not address them, as long as you did not bring them to the fore, they would continue to exist and smolder below the surface.
And so if we do not confront the contradictions that create joblessness and war and mass incarceration, they continue to fester as well.
That's right. My point exactly. My point exactly. And this is where we get back to this black petty bourgeoisie, who are more interested in their own comfort, in their own well-being, than they are in social justice. In fact, I think we can make an argument that a good part of the black petty bourgeoisie, and by this I mean well-paid academics, lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, all of those who do far better than the vast majority of people, they are more interested in their own security, their own comfort, than they are in racial progress for the masses of black people.
And therefore are unfit as leaders of the race, as we used to call it.
Oh, well, there's no question. There's no question. And this is one of the great problems of the present moment. Where will the next leadership of the race come from? And obviously, most of what are called civil rights leaders are not leaders at all, and certainly have no connection to the fight for civil rights in the 21st century, which have to do with mass incarceration, police brutality, unemployment, and of course, these attacks upon civil liberties that are institutionalized in the war on terror, as it is called.
Professor Tony Montero of Temple University in Philadelphia. Black women who work full-time suffer from a deep and pervasive wage gap. A new study based on U.S. Census Bureau data shows that black women make a fraction of men's paychecks. The analysis was done by the National Partnership for Women and Families. The group's director of workplace fairness, Sarah Crawford, says she wasn't surprised.
It is fairly shocking information, but it wasn't necessarily surprising to me because we have known for a while, unfortunately, that the pay gap is particularly punishing for women of color in this country. On average, women in this country bring home just 77 cents for every dollar that men are paid. But for women of color, the pay gap is even worse. And we found that for African American women, that pay gap is unfortunately just 70 cents on the dollar.
Now, that has a devastating impact on black America because female-headed households predominate in African America.
That's right. There are millions of family households in the United States that are headed by African American women. So, you know, we're particularly concerned about the impact of the pay gap for those families. And we also know that nearly 40% of all of those households headed by African American women live below the poverty level. So this lost pay due to the pay gap is particularly critical for those families. We looked at across the country for African American women, the difference in earnings amounts to over $14,000 each year. And we found that that could go very far. It could cover 2 years worth of food or 10 months worth of mortgage and utilities payments or 3 years worth of family health insurance premiums. So eliminating the pay gap could provide critical information to families that need that money.
Give us some idea of where the gap is largest and where it's smallest.
Sure. So we looked at the pay gap in the 20 states with the largest populations of African American women who work full year, full time. And we found that the gap was largest in the state of Louisiana, where it amounted to a difference of over $20,000 between the earnings of African American women and earnings for men in that state. So that amounts to a difference of 55 cents on the dollar that's paid to men.
And where is the gap smallest?
Among the 20 states, we found California also has a large population of about 300,000 African American women who work full year, full time. And there, women do a little bit better, bringing home 87 cents on the dollar. But even in that state, with a smaller wage gap, it's still a significant difference of over $6,000 a year.
And do these differences in the wage gap geographically have any connection to workplace protections in those states?
Well, there's a strong case to be made for that. California tends to have stronger laws in place. There's certainly a number of factors at play, but we certainly believe that this analysis provides further evidence of the need for federal solution, and in particular, the Paycheck Fairness Act, which would strengthen protections from pay discrimination.
And how high a priority is that legislation for the Obama administration and for congressional leadership in both parties?
Well, we understand that it is a strong priority. We're in a new Congress this year. The bill will be introduced shortly. Certainly, this president supports the bill, and he made the issue of fair pay an issue in the election, and people heard that message, and it certainly came across as a priority issue, so we certainly are hoping that it moves as such in this Congress.
In terms of the wage gap and the gap between the states, would this have anything to do with right-to-work laws?
It may be. You know, there's certainly a number of factors that can come into play. You know, we find, interestingly, when you look within industries, the industry with the smallest pay gap is the construction industry. It's not an industry where there are a lot of women working, but we find that those women who are working in the construction industry have a smaller wage gap overall. And I do think that that is in part explained by the fact that wages are commonly set in that industry by collective bargaining agreements. So certainly that can play a factor.
And in terms of mobilization behind this legislation, what's going on?
We have a strong coalition of groups that is constantly messaging about the importance of this issue for women across this country. That coalition will be meeting with the White House shortly to again emphasize the importance of measures like the Paycheck Fairness Act. We are meeting with members of Congress. So it's a very engaged and active coalition.
Sarah Crawford of the National Partnership for Women and Families in Washington. The so-called fiscal cliff has been patched up, but that has not slowed the austerity train. We asked Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, if the future of Social Security and other entitlements remains in doubt.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, part of the story is that the conservatives, the Republicans, however you want to put it, the business lobby, they've been allowed to control the debate because they've created this idea of this crisis, that we have this big deficit crisis. And it really is a fiction, and it's not really a debatable point. We had relatively small deficits until the economy collapsed following the collapse of the housing bubble. So if you go back to 2007, deficits were just over 1% of GDP. I mean, these are still big numbers, but the reality is a deficit of 1% of GDP is not a big deal. We could do that literally forever. What happened was the economy collapsed. When the economy goes down, we collect less money in taxes. We pay out more money for things like unemployment benefits. And, of course, we had deliberate policy. We had the stimulus. Those were tax cuts, spending increases to counteract the downturn. But if you took out the effect of the downturn, we'd be back with those small deficits. So for these people to run around yelling about, oh, trillion-dollar deficits, you know, our house is out of order, our fiscal house is out of order, it's really nonsense. It's really nonsense. And, you know, as long as you have that dominating the debate, then you have a big risk that programs like Medicare and Social Security will be on the chopping block because, you know, let's be honest, that is where the money is. Now, it doesn't make sense to cut them because, you know, these are programs that people badly need. They paid for them, certainly in the case of Social Security. And, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to cut them. But if you are going to say we have to reduce deficits and, you know, there's kind of a lock, we got all the tax revenue we're going to get or probably most of it, well, where are you going to go? So we do have a big problem with the nature of this debate. It's starting from fundamentally false assumptions, but if we don't challenge those assumptions, then, you know, programs that people really depend on are on the chopping block.
Well, these people that you refer to also include President Obama, who even before he was sworn in, put entitlements, all of them, including Social Security, on the table.
That's certainly been a big disappointment to me and many other people because, you know, certainly the president and his advisors, they know the reality of these programs. They know both that, you know, Social Security is an essential program. Most seniors really do need it. I mean, the idea that we have these high-living seniors, you know, we have Pete Peterson, the Wall Street investment banker, who's made a second career of going after Social Security and Medicare. He always goes around saying, I don't need my Social Security, I don't need my Medicare, and, you know, that's no doubt true. But reality is we have the data. The vast majority of seniors are heavily dependent on these programs. 40% rely on Social Security for almost all their income, and 70% rely on it for more than half their income. So the idea that we have a large number of seniors who are living very well and could, you know, just see big cuts to these programs, that really doesn't make any sense. And, you know, President Obama's advisors know that, so their willingness to go along with these cuts is very discouraging.
That was Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. Last week, Your World News held a national radio forum on police brutality and institutional racism. The program was hosted by Solomon Komasong and Peter Fowler and invited victims of the criminal justice system to recount their experiences on the air. Among the guests was Callie Acuno of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, who was one of the authors of a report on the extrajudicial killing of black people, one every 36 hours. Acuno explained how the project got started.
We were gathering this information to try and make sure that we presented it to our people so folks had a full extent of the atrocity that was being committed against us and is not being reported, not being talked about, and basically being silenced. And what prompted us to do it, just so folks are clear, we were doing an assessment back in 2008, once it looked like Obama had an opportunity to win, that was going to lead to an upsurge in white reaction and white supremacist violence against our community. And we started just kind of pay attention to do a watch, and we were watching the gun sales go up shortly after he got elected, other responses that were going on in terms of quote-unquote hate crimes. But what really tipped it off was when New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, 2008, 2009, there were three brothers, two of whom got killed, one of which got shot by the police. There was very little outrage in the mainstream media, and it really took the will of the people, particularly those in New Orleans and in Oakland, to really uprise and make their voices heard and keep the names out there of Robbie Tolan and Oscar Grant, you know, make them household names from what they were doing in the community. So we just started paying attention from that point on and documenting as best we could. You know, we were strictly a political organization that relies on, you know, the sweat and blood of our members. Nobody gets paid to do any of this work. So we would gather information here and there, compile it, put out little things here and there, but we didn't decide to really systematically do it until the end of really 2011, when we saw that the spike was really going up. I'm based in Atlanta. We saw just in, I think, between November and December of 2011 that there were close to, I think, eight brothers who had got killed just in metro Atlanta area alone. That was end of 2011. And then in January 2012, we saw that there were close to, I think by the end of January, there were close to, I think it was 12 of our brothers and sisters who had been executed by the police. This is before the Trayvon Martin piece had really got blown up. So off of that, we started to say, if we got to take some responsibility to inform our people and to encourage them wherever they are to organize in their self-defense. And so that's how this piece really came about, and that's how we continue to try to use it. And why it's important is if we look at the pace, based on the work that we're doing now, we're working on an annual report for 2012, but probably before that's even penned and inked and put out for folks to utilize in their organizing efforts, we're already noticing that just by kind of a summary account that we are, what, 8 days into the Roman calendar year of 2013, and by our count, we still have some work to do to verify a few things, but by our count, there's already been 10 black men who've been killed by police in 2013. So that's faster than the pace of 2012. So it shows you how critical this situation is and what type of organizing work we need to do on a mass level to defend ourselves.
Carly, this is Peter Fowler. It's good to have you on the show, brother, and I appreciate the work that you all are doing. Could you talk a little bit about the structural issues that are behind the issue of these extrajudicial killings and police brutality and so forth, you know, in terms of what's inherent in the system and why this is a problem in the United States today?
From our perspective, let me break it down, that we are colonial subjects, and you have, that is African people in this country, and you have a situation where the economic edifice, the political and social edifice is very much dependent upon our ongoing subjugation. But, you know, like all peoples who have dignity, we fight back. We don't follow orders. We assert our independence. We strive for liberation. And that messes up the order of things. And if you look at the overall system right now and how it's a bit shaky, the economics of the society is shaky. The politics are all over the place. The ruling class of this country clearly don't have a plan of its own. They're really in some serious crisis management mode. And one could argue that they're trying to kind of bear down the hatches, if you will, and hold on to everything they got. Then you put us in the midst of that, trying to survive, you know, trying to thrive in a society as we understand it. You have a system where they basically have to contain us. It produces that kind of dynamic because they're not, at least under the capitalist logic, there are not enough resources to go around. And you have a group of folks who have no intention on distributing the wealth that is produced by society throughout the world, particularly in this country. They have no intention on distributing equally. And if you're going to keep a system of have and have nots, you better make sure that if you're on the have side, that you are fortified to keep all of your possessions. And that's basically what the United States government has set up. But it's in crisis mode if you look at what's been going on the global scale economically since the, I would call it a fabricated crisis around credit in 2008. Unemployment, particularly of black people in many places, is over 50%. That may be undercount. And their option has been really since the deindustrialization and kind of the what people call offshoring of production since the late 1960s and 1970s and 80s. Their solution for us has been to warehouse us in prisons. When that winds up not being the most effective and efficient means to deal with our people, because it's a crunch on their budgets in many states. If you look at some of the reforms that are going on, particularly in some of the South, or even some of the more conservative reactionary forces are saying they got to find some alternatives to prisons because it's too expensive, then you wind up with a situation where if you can't house people in warehouses, if your just basic repression of them on the street isn't sufficient enough, you know, your other option is to kill them, because we are deemed to be disposable within this system. And that's what you see, that black life really has no value, so it can be snuffed out at a whim. I mean, that's basically what we see going on, and I think what these statistics bear out. And you can just really look at the system in an overall comprehensive way. The extrajudicial killings, these murders, are really kind of just one sliver of the overall pie. When you look at the whole kind of edifice of the national security state or the garrison state, whatever you want to call it, in terms of the surveillance, in terms of the stop and frisk policies, whether it be called something else in a different community, a weed and seed or whatever. And if you look at the mass incarceration and you put that in its totality, you could easily say that if you are an African male in this society, at some point in your life, you're going to be detained by the police at the very least. And we already know that one in three of us at some point in our lifetime are likely to go to prison in this society. But how do you get that one in three? You know, what are the steps that are set up to get you to that point, you know, from the school to prison pipeline on down? So, you know, we really have to break it down. And again, this is just one piece, and we were trying to highlight this one piece because it really kind of, you know, shines a spotlight on how desperate the system has become. And I think it really points to the type of work we need to do in our community to reassert our self-determination and our right to self-defense.
Kali Okuno of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement on Your World News. President Obama has nominated former Republican Senator Chuck Hagel to be his next Secretary of Defense and White House National Security Advisor John Brennan to head the CIA. Sam Husseini handles communications for the Institute for Public Accuracy in Washington. We asked Husseini why it seems that Obama always chooses the most aggressive, pro-war people and puts them in positions where they can do the most harm.
Yeah, it's been remarkable. I mean, in so much of the covers that we've seen, Hagel is constantly referred to as being anti-war in some way. And he was tactically critical of the Iraq war eventually, but he voted for it. And one is hard-pressed to find any reports that just acknowledge that presumably simple and critical fact. It's a pattern. It's virtually everybody on the top echelon of the Obama foreign policy team, they all back the Iraq war. Either if they were in the Senate at the time, as in the case of Joe Biden, his vice president, Hillary Clinton, his first Secretary of State, John Kerry, who he just also nominated to be his second Secretary of State, Chuck Hagel, to head the Pentagon, of course, Gates, he carried over from Bush, and the rest of the prominent people. Susan Rice backed the Iraq War. She wasn't in the Senate, of course, but she backed it and, you know, regurgitated the claims of the Bush administration about Iraqi WMDs, as did all of the people that I just mentioned. So it's, even though Obama presumably got the nomination in 2008, in large part on the basis of his having spoken out, he didn't vote, of giving a speech that was critical critical in a tactical way of the then impending Iraq war. For his cabinet appointees, appointed to a man and a woman, people who backed the Iraq war, even if they're being packaged now as somehow anti-war. Now, Hegel has been more reluctant than some about pursuing Iran, and there's been a lot of ink spilled about his rift with the neocons and with the Republicans and so on. But he hasn't broken in any substantial way. And I question Hegel, as I did Kerry, about their Iraq war votes. And Hegel really didn't come clean in any meaningful way when I questioned him. Kerry, when I questioned him, claimed that from the moment that Bush misused it, he spoke out against it. And I could find absolutely no record of that. I found quite the opposite. In Kerry's case, he started attacking Bush from the right in 2003, saying that he was concerned that the Bush administration was pursuing a cut-and-run policy in Iraq.
John Brennan and the word continuity go together. He is deeply associated with torture, drone warfare, the kill list, and he's going to be tapped for director of the CIA.
Indeed, and Obama put out the nominations of both Hegel and Brennan at the same time, and it was a Monday, and if we're to believe New York Times report of in-depth investigation on drone killings and so on, the following day he and Brennan met to decide who they were going to kill, and we have seen several attacks in the days since then of U.S. drone strikes killing people in Pakistan. So this is what he has done as the main intelligence person at the White House, and in what would seem to be signaling that there would be an expansion of this kind of thing, that he would be heading up the CIA. And he at one point claimed that there were no civilian deaths from the drone program, even though we know of civilian deaths. So he's the executor of these policies, which would seem to run counter to minimal criteria of rule of law, judicial oversight, and it's all under the guise of, we've got to fight the terrorists. He was questioned by Helen Thomas a couple of years ago about, why does Al-Qaeda hate us? Why are they doing these things? And he couldn't muster anything really than, it's religion, and Al-Qaeda's misusing religion. And then she pressed him, well, why? Why are they doing this? That's what they are. This is what Al-Qaeda does. They're hardwired into this, and they're using Islam to pursue this. There was absolutely no thought given as to what concrete motivations would be. Obama came in allegedly curtailing use of torture, which Brennan was heavily involved in the Bush administration, and he and Brennan have, it seems, to a large extent, moved away from torture in favor of assassination. So you don't abduct people and torture them, you just outright kill them. And that's been the policy that Obama has pursued largely from the beginning, and Brennan has been the point man on this.
So it seems we have a guy who will become head of the CIA who is heavy in execution and not too heavy on analysis of why you're executing, torturing other people.
Even assuming that you're talking about just the quote-unquote bad guys and the members of Al-Qaeda, he doesn't seem keen on figuring out why they would want to attack the United States. So now we're executing people and killing civilians in Pakistan. So what is that breeding? Further resentment. Pakistan, which has nuclear weapons. There seems to be no discernible understanding of the dynamics. I mean, there's the ethical question of you're killing people without any judicial oversight. There's the ethical question of you're trying to kill alleged members of Al-Qaeda and you are killing civilians quite frequently, and then there's the pragmatic question of you're causing a lot of people to hate you, and they're going to probably want to attack you as a result of that. And he seems to have no understanding of all three of those factors.
And yet President Obama wants to put him at the top of the nation's foremost intelligence agency.
And it's a further politicization of intelligence. I mean, not just Brennan in person, but just the fact that he's coming out of the White House, in effect. He was elevated under Tenet, who politicized intelligence to justify the Iraq war.
And President Obama knows him well. Brennan says they meet every day.
They meet every day. He is frequently the last person in the room, it is said, with Obama before major foreign policy decisions are made, particularly regarding drone killing. And they especially meet on Tuesdays to decide who to kill.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio. Information for liberation.